One thing they tried to do, especially in the Obama administration, was sort of steer away from religious conversations directly.
Yeah,
So we're not
or
going to sit
just.
down and work out these problems. But say, like, look, we know what your issues are. Let's figure out the deeper problems, right? Is it economic concerns? Is that you don't have a job? Is it that, your family is broken, and address those? And instead of, sitting young Muslim men down and talking about the Quran and why you shouldn't be a terrorist, it was more about, it's like, what do you want to do with your life? Do you want to start a business? Things like that. And it would kind of take that energy and direct it in a more productive area.
Welcome to Crossing Faiths, the largest multi-faith podcast out there. Talk religion and politics. I'm here with Dr. Henny from the University of Vermont, who, when I reached out to the gentleman, it was about his article, Escaping the Downward Spiral, What Academic Literature Says About Racing Religious Conflict. And I go, this guy's thinking. And then when we sat down and had a little chat before the podcast, it turns out that we had known each other for 10 years. I just didn't recognize him because we were both we're out of our suits. And back in the day, both of our hair was a little bit more luxuriant. Welcome, Dr. Henny.
Right. Thanks for having me on. I
Yeah.
still have
So
plenty of hair, but
you do. It's just, I saw the picture of you giving the speech, and you had this just luxuriant mane. And I saw that picture of you with beard, the kind of, and I go, God, okay, I remember him. I go, okay, we're working at the Pew at Pew Research Center for and working with Brian Grimm, Dr. Grimm, on the first report on religious persecution that we quote all the time, and it gets updated every year. But we were there for a short time, almost 2.5 years. And then
That's right.
moved
I started
on.
there in grad school, and then actually when Brian moved on to start his Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, I came back to run the project for 2 years, and then I went into academia. I was kind of missing teaching and the like.
I mean, maybe we just I we're gonna, I would love to lead into this article and talk about your book, but maybe we just for a moment. It was lightning in the bottle at that time. You and Brian were doing something that had never been done before, and you were creating a code book, a rubric of religious persecution globally, and nothing really has been done since that time. It's really just been updating that evaluation. And there was some research that had been done on sort of outliers, but you could just describe like that element of your discovery, the aha moment when that report came out, or as you were kind of walking through developing that analysis.
Sure. I mean, most of the credit's got to go to Brian. It came out of Brian Grimm's work at Penn State University, where he was doing his PhD. And his first book with Roger Finke was the first version of this. So his idea that we know religious freedom is under threat around the world from both governments and societies. And is there a way to quantify that? And the first impulse is no. How do you quantify something like religious freedom? But what Brian did was broke it down into a set of precise indicators that we can then sum up into a score of 0 to 10, something like a Freedom House score. And that lets us compare across countries. And then once it moved to Pew, where they had funding to continue year after year, we could look at changes over time. And it was, it's interesting because on the one hand, it sort of validated what we already knew. So a country like China or Iran is pretty repressive. Other things stuck out. Europe often has a lot more religious tensions than people realize, and that came out in the data. One year, when I was running the project, one of the big findings was an increase in the number of countries where Jewish people were persecuted. And like, we know anti-Semitism is a threat, but having that on paper was useful to see. So I think it was a good project. There's other projects beyond that, looking at different areas. So Jonathan Fox at Bar Ilan University has his Religion and State project that sort of overlapped with the Pew data. It captures a lot more information. It's a little more academic focused. So they've been doing things like that. And then other people have used Brian's data and Jonathan's data to do all these studies. So, I mean, this Pew data helped me really get through grad school in terms of my first couple of publications. If you look at how does these levels of religious restriction and levels of religious tension, how do they correspond to other things like refugee crises or international tensions, even United Nations voting, it has an effect on. So I think it was really good indicator for both the community, the academic community and the policy community that we need to take religious freedom seriously.
But I appreciate you kind of giving that little insight because I was on the outside of that, trying to advocate for religious persecution and taking a leadership role within American Islamic Congress and motivating the Ummah to make this sort of like the top number one item. And I remember people going, why would you do this? It's not really, it's a flash in the pan, and it hasn't been. And I remember people now I was like circling back with my executive director at the time. She says, Zainab Al-Sawaj, and she goes, it's such a good move to focus on this and parlay that information that we had, that data, into programs that had that had impact. And the hallmark of my career since then has been trying to figure out how do we dial in and contextualize evaluation, religious persecution, and use and enhance the rubric that was designed, or use it, use a method to transition that overlay into a contextualized model for collective cultures in Islamic context or post-Soviet context. And so, when I read your article, Escaping the Downward Spiral, and you say that, what academic literature can says about, race and religious conflict, and how you got into, the methods to ease religious conflicts, and emphasizing that these conflicts are not inevitable. I go, God, this guy's thinking. And then I saw your face and we started talking. I go, oh my God, I know this guy. Okay, here we go. So maybe you could walk me through the article a little bit. It's really, it's an addendum, I think, to your book, right? Religion and Peace Building. Is that appropriate to say?
Sort of, right? So yeah, some of the background is that my research has always been about the bad side of religion, sort of how religion leads to more conflict or causes problems for states. And I think that's true, but it's rough. I'm a person of faith myself, and I know the good side of religion, and I've always felt this tension. And I actually had this, I guess we can call it a spiritual moment. I was on sabbatical I was in Edinburgh last year, but we went to Rome, visited St. Peter's Square, and there's that sculpture there of angels unaware of about refugees and migrant crises. And it just sort of hit me like, I'd like to do something more than just talk about religion as horrible. And so I gained more of an interest in religion and peace building. And this, it was sort of random. I think it was via LinkedIn. Chris Seipel, who's very active in the religious freedom community, had become involved with the Haifa Laboratory for Religious Studies, University of Haifa in Israel, and they were starting just a new initiative. So I just reached out to the man running it and said, "Hey, I haven't done a lot on this because I work on religion and conflict, but I'd love to do something." And he said, "Oh, we have this new journal coming out. Why don't you can submit something." And so I thought it was just, I'd like to organize my thoughts via this article in terms of what is religious conflict and what we do about it, right? So I think some people have this sense of religious conflict as inevitable. I talk about the ancient hatreds idea, which I remember coming up as a kid in the 90s, that, they've always been fighting, they always will fight. That's not really true, right? People coexist peacefully for long periods, and much of religious conflict is really socially constructed, meaning there's a shift in ideas and practices that hardens this religious division, and then you get stuck in that downward spiral where it just gets worse and worse. And so academic research tells us what to do about that. And so there's different approaches out there. There's the institutional approach, which is relates to religious freedom, that a lot of religious conflict comes from religious repression. So we ease up on the repression that'll fix things. There's a doctrinal approach. So we sort of find the exclusive extremist ideologies and find a way to nudge them in a more inclusive direction or pluralistic direction. Well, there's also small scale dialogue efforts, which We don't have as much good data on in terms of when they work, but there's lots of interesting projects on the fact that they are happening, which is something. And there's also this question of maybe we need to desacralize things, as Isaac Svensson wrote about. He's at Uppsala University. That religious conflicts, we need to maybe take religion out of the equation and find some way to resolve it without directly confronting those religious ideas. And I don't have good answers yet. I'd love to, continue working on this and figure out which of these works and when. But I've been drawn more and more towards these small scale engagement that we're not going to have, we're not going to have one big conference that'll solve everything, but you have face-to-face encounters between different people, different faiths, or people of the same faith, but who disagree on key issues, and that can start to gradually build up trust. And this is something in the terrorism literature I've been working on as well. So that kind of ties in with my book. The book was more on how states try to use religion and foreign policy, and they fail is the takeaway. But the policy takeaway is that the only times it does work is when it's these humble, small scale, modest initiatives, right? Like, the US government, sitting down with Muslim leaders and trying to develop trust as opposed to surveillance, things like that.
Right. Yeah. Because when I was at the American Islamic Congress, when we were, I were interacting, we had a lot of programming, and was the contextualization sort of lens that that the light went through when we were in the Middle East and engaging in the MENA region, the Middle East, North Africa region. And so we were, had funded by the Department of State, we were funded by USAID, and of course by the enemies of the United States. We were a CIA agent. Everybody said we were members of the CIA. And it didn't help that AIC backwards is CIA, the acronym. So it was really funny. Everybody turned around and go, your acronym backward is the CIA. I go, do you think that's how it works? Somebody
It's
really
not a
put it
great
together hard.
disguise.
What's that?
I said it's not a great disguise.
So it's like when I did an event with the Lali Da with the Dalai Lama, we codenamed the Dalai Lama, the Lali Dama. And he said, "But do you think everybody will figure it out?" All the guys at diplomatic security were really laughing at it. I go, why would we be so careful? But in any event, you're right, the small scale programs, the practical elements of developing engagement modeling with people who understand, the culture, ethnicity, and the different diversities, the interfaith and multifaith diversity that's out there is where it's at. But what maybe you could tell me, what do you when it comes to this small scale engagement and the research you're doing, how does where do you, what do you, what did you discover in as sort of religion? You said your book is a little bit more positive on it, but when it comes to religion and peace building, what do you think? What did you discover? What was the element? What's the aha moment? Where you go, this is probably what it should look like. I mean, I don't have all the pieces right now, but this is what it should look and feel and taste like.
Sure. So I actually think the book is a little more pessimistic than optimistic in that I was setting out to find examples of states using religion as a tool in a way that really aligned their values and their interests. And what I found was most of the time when states try to incorporate religion into interstate crises and power politics, it just raises the blood pressure of everyone in the room. It gets out of hand. In terms of examples that worked, in the US context, there weren't a whole lot because most people talked about is the struggles they'd had to clarify things. But there were a couple of things that came up. Someone had talked about it is a US government funded program where an NGO worked with religious schools in Pakistan to look at their textbooks. And it was sort of a collaborative effort. So it wasn't so much America coming in and saying, this textbook's bad, get rid of it. But it was like the NGO kind of capacity building, working capacity building efforts with religious schools. And that actually would be one common theme is when the efforts are focused more on not so much telling people what to say or argue or finding, the moderate Muslim scholar, I'm doing quotes, right? It's working and finding a good, local women's group or religious discussion group. And sort of teaching them how to engage with the government, how to engage with other groups, how to train their members, something like that. Other examples, not always came from my book, but I remember it coming out of Brian Grimm's new initiative, the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. Right, there's one example I remember he talked about of a counter-extremism program in the United Kingdom. And instead of, sitting young Muslim men down and talking about the Quran and why you shouldn't be a terrorist, it was more about, it's like, what do you want to do with your life? Do you want to start a business? Things like that. And it would kind of take that energy and direct it in a more productive area. And so that's actually one theme that came out in the book when I talked to US policymakers or former policymakers, is that one thing they tried to do, especially in the Obama administration, was sort of steer away from religious conversations directly.
Yeah,
So we're not
or
going to sit
just
down and work out these problems, but say, like, look, we know what your issues are. Let's figure out the deeper problems, right? Is it economic concerns? Is that you don't have a job? Is it that, your family is broken, and address those?
right.
And I think religion still has a role to play there in terms of providing a social foundation for that, but we don't need, these kind of direct, large, grand interfaith dialogue efforts to get there.
Well, and interfaith, conversations are pretty mature. There's a lot of multi-faith meetings on, the micro-macro level. Religious engagement is pretty healthy. The challenge, I think, is that the U.S. government, by and large, my interaction has been, they don't want to talk about religion at all. So, implicitly or explicitly. And so the problem is, if you don't acknowledge it as a core element in populations that in countries we're interacting with, and we have programming or conflict in, then you can't get to the economic development, right? The education, security, and so forth. And so, I mean, is it, when you're talking about, this article is focused on, like, these non-religious factors to de-escalate conflicts. So you're not necessarily ignoring religion, but you're understanding that the factors, the touch points are, I need to feed my family, I need to earn a living, I need to build my life, and generally people that are prosperous are not going to slide into some kind of militant stance with or develop poor relationships with individuals or constituencies that become their enemies. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically, right. I didn't want to go too far in the other direction of ignoring religion. And I think where it matters is if you can prove you speak the language, so to speak, right? So religion is a core part of people's identity. And if you can demonstrate, I know and I care about that and I recognize that, that matters. So one of the findings in the book was that credibility is going to be a key source of success, right? If you're issuing religious appeals or religious initiatives, and people believe what you're saying, then they'll listen to you. And that's where religion comes in. So if you can have someone who can, maybe a fellow Muslim or at least a person of faith talking to them, that initial bond can be formed, and then you can move on to the other areas. I always think, one of my friends in DC, who's Muslim, we go out to eat and have these conversations, and it wouldn't be about the Bible versus the Quran or anything, but it would be these nitty-gritty, like, I'm going to have a party, should I serve alcohol or not, and what have you. But we had that common foundation. We were both people of faith, and we felt comfortable talking about the tricky, what could be tricky, controversial areas of interaction between us. And that's one big thing that comes up with people is religious literacy, right? So
Right.
we need to increase religious literacy. You mentioned the government's afraid of talking about religion. I've encountered that as well. And I know, the areas you've worked in and the broader religious freedom community has tried to address that with the classes in the Foreign Service Institute. I gave lectures for those. And that can help. It's just so when our foreign service officers or others get out there and meet with people, they don't feel nervous to bring up religious issues. Chaplains has come up as a possible resource
Sure.
for religious engagement. I mentioned that in a talk I gave recently, and a couple military members in the audience were like, we haven't had a lot of success with that, but I think it's a good idea, right? That
Yeah,
the religious people we already have.
it's tough. It's tough. I worked at FSI, Foreign Service Institute, and they brought me in to speak on just a on Islam in an Afghan context, right? And you know, I'm an Afghan descent, so I started the course, and it was, you know, diplomats and military guys and everybody, and we get one class in, and people raise their hands, and they go, you know, well, because I'm talking about Abrahamic lineage, and I'm talking about, you know, Islam, and they go, well, you know, can you step back, and can you teach us what Islam is? So then I had to develop an Islam 101 course. And
Right.
then once I started talking about Islam 101, I started talking about Abrahamic lineage, and I started talking about this. And they go, "Can you? So, what do you mean by Abrahamic lineage?" And then before you know it, we're developing Abrahamic faiths course, and so developed this whole curriculum. But it was shocking to be in a room with very educated people, very diverse population of people, you know, classes of 300, and like I said, from, you know, deploying military personnel all the way through to career diplomats, and they didn't know anything about religion, or were didn't have the whole picture, and depending on where they came from, they were very extremely nervous to even discuss the issue, but we were lucky enough to have people raise their hands and stuff, and I, at that point, I was teaching the class with my wife, so it was the two of us, you know, husband, wife, you know, Muslim team going in, and answering questions, you know, safe space type of situation, you know, and I always say, like, you know, when it comes to women in Islam, I'll let my wife answer all the questions, you know, but we kind of went into it, and that was very telling to me, you know, and this is early in my career. Now they have some mature programming, and my curriculum's floating around there somewhere. But you're right. It's difficult because religion literacy is such a where do you go for that? If you go to somebody just as a person of faith from a particular faith group, then you're at one beach of the pond, or you can't go to one Catholic priest to represent all of Catholicism, right? Because so it might be they might we don't know where they fall in the pantheon of Catholicism, and so. I think that there's a really big challenge of trying to figure out how do you what who develops the curriculum, how does it get developed, and then how do you and who conducts the training. In the latter part of my career, religion and media has been a big part of it. And you know, the first when a media firm wants to cut their budget, the first thing they cut is the religion reporter. They don't cut the sports guy, you know. And so then when there's an issue on religion, they send anybody out to go report on it. And so that religion literacy becomes really important when you're talking about something that has to do with faith. Because and if you don't have somebody who has that religious literacy, it changes the way in which that they may or may not see the appropriate things to report objectively on the issue. And so but it's the same thing when it comes to what you're talking about, religion and conflict. You need people that understand faith and understand belief, and are able to engage appropriately and comfortably, even with someone that isn't of their faith, but understands the nuances of how a faith community works. And so, is that one of your dividends out of the book?
I think so. Yeah. And so understand faith, or at the very least, recognize its importance. So I'm not an expert on nuclear weapons, but if someone comes in and gives a presentation on the threat of a nuclear attack, I'm like, yeah, okay, I agree with you. That's right.
Right.
It doesn't always go the other way, right? If for a lot of people who work in like the hardcore security areas, in the government or academia, they just don't quite see religion mattering that much. And I gave a talk recently and on my book, and someone's like, well, okay, fine. They might say religion matters, but is that true? And like, would you say that of anything else? Like, if I have archival evidence, right, of
Right.
Nasser, the president of Egypt, saying I'm worried about these religious overtures from the Saudi government, why would we question that? And there's this inherent skepticism. And I early in grad school, I gave a paper on Turkey, religion and foreign policy in Turkey, and the discussion at the conference was like, well, I'm not really religious. No one I know is religious. I'm not sure it matters. And I was like, well, I don't. Okay. That's the response you get. That's
Sure.
changing. It's gotten a lot better. I mean, the fact that, we'd have those international religious freedom roundtables and State Department people would be there, that's great. The fact that there's the International Religious Freedom Office is something. The U.S. Institute for Peace had that big project with USAID on religion and religious freedom or engagement,
Religion
I
and
think.
law, yeah.
Yeah. So that's like there's more and more recognition of that. But one of the other issues, and this is something I try to do in the book, is to end this sort of preaching to the choir effect, in
Right.
that what often happens in both academia and policy worlds is that those of us who think religion's important and matters, we get together and we say that to each other, and we all agree with each other. And everyone who disagrees with us is in a different room, and we never have a real debate. And this happened with religious freedom a lot, where we have these events, and everyone would say religious freedom's the most important right there is. Like, okay. There's a lot of interesting, not a lot of more interesting things to say about that. Whereas actually, when a real debate is like, when is it important, under what conditions, and it's hard to push that. So one thing I was trying to do with my book was I was talking about here's some core security areas of international rivalry, counterterrorism, and here's evidence of states trying to use religion as big impact. So even if you disagree with me, you at least have to ideally read the book and explain why I'm wrong, like push back on me. And so I think more of that dialogue would be helpful in both academia and the policy worlds.
Well, I appreciate your input, your insight on this, because it's like it's such a it's a it's it, you know you're again, I read your article, God, this guy's thinking, and then like you said, it turns out our community's so small, so it turns out we know each other, right? And and it's even more incestuous because you went to Vassar, which when I was and I'm from Poughkeepsie, so it's really kind of funny, yeah. And we all know the same people out there, but what's the so here's the thing. You have this sort of, you said it's kind of a your outcomes from the book are somewhat pessimistic. So what are you doing with that? What's the next, what's the so what now? What's the next thing that you're kind of like looking at from as a dividend of the book, as a motivator to your next research and investigation.
Sure. Well, I think, some people think pessimism is a bad thing. I think it's a good thing, right? It's recognizing reality. And so accordingly, one of the biggest inspirations for the book was Reinhold Niebuhr, right? This classic realist, big foreign policy thinker in the early Cold War, who talked about the way that America has these wonderful grand ideals and virtues that we just turn into vices, right? Because we get overexcited and we go out on these crusades. And that was sort of the framing of the book, and I get back into it in the conclusion. Like, this is the real takeaway: is we need to abandon these broad liberal dreams of changing the world, but we don't need to give in to fatalism that religious conflicts are inevitable, right? Being modest and humble is a great start, and that's more of a paradigm than a specific policy recommendation. But I think it's an important paradigm to develop, to think that, if we say there's conflict in Nigeria between, Muslims and Christians, or, the different ethnic groups, what do we do about it? And so finding a specific village where we can bring people together and work on that, something like that, as opposed to just, I don't know, having a meeting in DC about it, right?
Right.
So I do think there's optimism there in the sense of recognizing what we can't do lets us focus on what we can. So the next project for the next book is going to be more looking into that. But there's all this element. We went to talk about the USIP work. A good friend of mine, Jason Klocek at University of Nottingham in England, has done some work on that, where they're trying to study which types of religious engagement work and which don't. Another friend of mine, David Mallett, he's at American University, I think, has worked on this with countering violent extremism, right? So the idea that we can prevent terrorism by interrupting the radicalization process. And he's starting to come up with metrics to understand when is this actually having an effect. Like, when are people learning a better way to deal with negative issues or problems? And so I think there's a lot of the work like that that we can draw on. And so I see myself as a sort of the cranky outsider at this moment, of just saying, like, be careful what you do, like, take tiny baby steps, but you need someone to push you in that direction. And then
Right.
hopefully I can do more productive stuff with the new projects that I'm working on.
Right on. I'm a practitioner, so I'm one of these guys that's like kind of like going through this sort of this tunnel. And when it comes to, you know, being a young buck and really passionate about the issue, you know, about religious freedom, persecution, religion, and conflict. And now I'm kind of at the other, on the other side of it, where I'm going, okay, these are my observations. Let me get them all out into in a paper. And so, you know, I think the idea of, you know, this origin of your coming out of grad school from the pew to, you know, these putting together this, I mean, it's really the standard of religious persecution, right? The idea of religion and conflict, and then it actually morphing into what you're doing now, which is, you know, establishing an idea of how, you know, you get into religious conflict. What are the factors for engagement? How do we approach it from a policy or practical standpoint when it comes to programming, and then figuring out how what might work and what might not work, but being real, accepting the reality that we're in, I think, and I think that's what I'm getting for you about this sort of like this idea of the pessimism, was we have to kind of embrace the reality that we have faith groups, that we have to confront the idea that we have to have religion, religious literacy in some manner, shape, or form, at least acknowledge religion, and then go from there and take a step forward, you know, and to address conflict or to address progress. How do we help all these different populations get from point A to point B? And America is a beacon for that, right? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, no, yeah, I think so. Right, and America is a good experiment, right? Because we have so many policies, we've tried so much, we've failed so much, but we also have these opportunities to keep trying again, and that's a good thing. And that's I was thinking about just the religious freedom circle and those initiatives. Where when I started out, you know, there's a sort of name and shame impulse. The goal is you take this data from Pew, figure out who the worst aggressors are, and then you press Congress to declare them the country of particular concern. And
Right, yeah.
it just never seems to have an effect. I just don't know that it's doing anything. And then this alternate approach that Chris Seipel had written about, I think it was an article on LinkedIn he posted, where it's more of this like building bridges approach, right?
Right,
So
his
yes,
second track diplomacy, you know, he's big
right,
on that. Yeah, track two
yeah, that
diplomacy,
like,
I think he kind of
yeah.
think he calls it. Yeah.
So like Pakistan obviously has horrible issues with religious freedom. Do we beat them over the head with the CP, the country of particular concern designation, until they change, which may not be possible? Or do we find ways to engage with Pakistani actors who are trying to do better and build up their capacity? And it feels less satisfying than just attacking someone. And it is more humble and modest and small scale, but that's where things are going to seem to matter. And so I mean, I'm separated from the religious freedom community because I'm now in Vermont rather than Washington, D.C., but I feel like I've also distanced myself a bit from them for that reason, that I'm less interested in the naming and shaming element. I think this comes up with interfaith dialogue as well, and I went to a lot of interfaith dialogue events when I was in D.C., and it's great. I 100% I'm behind them, but a lot of times the conversation involved, like, you know, Muslims and Christians, or you know, Muslims and Jewish people, Christians, we have similar faith backgrounds, so we don't need to kill each other. And
Right.
I'm like, I totally agree. Let's not kill each other. But there's a whole lot more of the nitty-gritty details of how we interact that we don't get to with those interfaith dialogue that are often trickier than don't kill each other,
Right. Yeah.
ironically, right? So I mentioned to
Got
my
it.
friend of like, is it okay to drink alcohol in front of her or not? Those conversations you feel like you can't ask, but you have to ask.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
he asked me, like, well, like, I always wonder, like, why do you keep the Old Testament in the Bible if you don't really follow it? And so we talked about views on that. Those questions that might come off as offensive, right? Unless you already build that foundation of trust. And it feels less significant to talk about something like that versus grand Abrahamic. And you need the grand Abrahamic discussions at first, right? But then you need to move on to something else.
Sure,
And that's where I
sure.
hope we're going with a lot of this.
Yeah, you know, the relation. I mean, this podcast is born out of a relationship between me and I was a director at American Islamic Congress, and Matthew Hawkins was a director at the Southern Baptist Conference. And so, we would figure out how to collaborate and could talk offline and send our, you know, advocacy letters to each other and be like, well, I'll change this wording here and I could probably support you. I can't support you on this initiative, but let me tell you what you could do if you really need some help, you know, and go to this guy, you know, or, you know, we used to kind of, you know, sit down and have a cup of coffee, and I used to do it with a lot of my colleagues back then when I was down in DC. You know, it helps to have a number that you can call to ask what's going on and who, what, you know, what's happening, and, you know, or at least be able to refer you to someone in country, where if you need some assistance with some kind of persecution issue or something that's very benign, you know, it's like where you're planning a party and you're like, what do I do? So it was just it makes sense. Well, I appreciate you taking the time, Doc, and you know, I hope to kind of follow up with you and have you come on to give some commentary, maybe on a couple of specific issues, and talk about what the work that you're doing, because it's very meaningful. Because you're like me, where I'm outside of DC now. I only go when I need to, and it's a liberation because you're not caught up in the Beltway community, which is both good and bad. But the idea is that, you know, I saw your article, and then we spoke about your book, and you know, you're doing amazing things right now. You know, no one is, there's not many people that are thinking this way into the so what and what now with religion and conflict, and for the reasons that we discussed, you know, people avoid it, people don't do this, and so I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. I mean, this is a great podcast, and your organization's doing incredible work. So I'm happy to be, you know, happy to be here.
Thanks so much.